It's football season, and we love it. We stream into bleachers to cheer our high school football teams. But our concerns about head trauma at the highest level of the game, filtering down to the high school and youth levels in Iowa. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll discuss how safety concerns are changing the game of football on fields across the state and what football's future may be. Joining us this hour, former NFL place kicker Nate Kading, sports commentator John U. Bacon, as well as others involved in football around the state. Have concerns about head trauma changed your mind about letting your kids play tackle football in school? Join our conversation after this news. Football season is upon us, and we Americans do love this sport. In fact, it's hard to say it's merely our nation's favorite sport. It's so wrapped up in our culture, our identity as Americans. Can we even imagine life in the U.S. without football? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we're not at the point of having to contemplate life without football, but there are worrying signs on the horizon as scientific studies of head trauma and concussions make the hazard of the game ever more clear. A couple of weeks ago, the NFL and more than 4,500 retired football players reached an agreement calling for the league to contribute $765 million to a fund that will pay medical and other benefits as well as compensation to those who suffered concussions and related injuries during their careers. And just last week, news that three former college football players are suing the NCAA, claiming that the institution failed to educate players and disclose the risks of concussion. This hour, we want to explore whether concerns about head trauma at the highest levels of the game are filtering down to high school and youth levels in Iowa and what football's future may be. We want to have you join our conversation. Have concerns about head trauma changed your mind about letting your kids play tackle football in school? Perhaps you're steering them to a less risky sport. What conversations are going on at your high school, at your junior high, among parents, with the coaches at the school? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, our email. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. We're also on Facebook. Joining us first of all, well, in just a moment, we'll be joined by former NFL place kicker Nate Kading, as well as others involved in football across the state. But first, let's go to John U. Bacon, sports commentator for Michigan Public Radio, author of Fourth and Long, The Fight to Save the Soul of College Football. John U. Bacon, welcome to River.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, just to mention briefly these lawsuits, tell us more about them. What's going on there? What are the plaintiffs seeking?
Well, they're seeking damages, of course, for their time as college football players. And well, the NFL, I think, actually got off fairly easily, which sounds crazy, for $765 million, as you discussed. But the players at one point were looking for $2 billion. And honestly, the damage done, they might have had a real shot at that. But the NFLPA has been surprisingly weak when dealing with the NFL owners and so on. And this kind of proved it. Now, what they have going for them with these lawsuits is both the college and the NFL players. Unlike workman's comp, say, at Ford Motor Company or, you know, Quaker Oats, not too far from you, and all the rest, is there is a ton of videotape showing, you know, guys who get banged up in a play and start walking funny or get into the wrong huddle or go to the wrong side of the field. So in that sense, I would say both the NFL and college football are very vulnerable. In the case of the NFL, I think they very wisely settled for a pretty reasonable amount. And what all businesses want to know is whatever their direct costs are, and then they're not open-ended. So the real thing the NFL got out of that deal is not just perhaps less money they might expect to pay, but that it's done. It is sealed. You can't sue them again. That's part of the deal. So the NFL got off pretty easily. I don't know if college will be as lucky.
Mm-hmm. So staying at the professional level, what does this mean for pro football? Many changes? Much incentive for change?
Yeah, you know, almost every problem that I've dealt with the last 20 years as a sports writer, often talking about Big Ten football, which is very popular in your backyard, of course, paying players, the bowl system, almost all this stuff, I can come up with some fairly clever, I hope, solutions. Not this one. This one is another planet killer, like the Ed O'Bannon players' rights case, that you know, you can certainly reduce hitting in practice, and we've discovered that it's not just the big hits that create long-term damage. It's also the tap, tap, tap of the linemen's of the linemen hitting each other every day in practice, not just the big hits. So I think practice has got to be itself changed. Your head does not really care if it's a big game or it's practice, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one issue there. Second issue is equipment. Third issue is going to be the rules. Now, they can cut it back fairly far and increase penalties for all kinds of head contact. But sooner or later, it will quit looking like football. So here's where you get the real dilemma, I think, of what is the threshold, the trade-off between safety and the pleasure of the fans. And this is where, in many ways, college football can become a guilty pleasure if we can't solve this problem.
So, John Ubakin, let's step back. You mentioned the implications of the NFL suit. So you said the NCAA suit, that the NCAA won't get off as easily as the NFL. What do you think?
Here's why, because NFL is an extremely well-run, tight organization, very, very strong commissioner from Pete Rozelle to the present. This goes back 50 years now. That is a cabal like no other. OPEC would envy its organization, I think. Those guys get together, they seal it up, that's it. NCAA football, Division I alone, is 125 members, and they're not all on the same page. They don't have the same values. They don't have the same way of looking at things. Trying to organize those guys can be very difficult, and let's keep in mind, too, that unlike the money, concussions do not care again about Division II or Division III. They are also vulnerable, and I'm willing to bet you'll start seeing Division II and III schools dropping it, a la the University of Chicago.
Okay. Did they drop it recently?
They dropped Division I football in 1939 when Amos Alonzo Stagg was actually retired right before then. But the stands of Chicago Stadium were used by Enrico Fermi to conduct the first controlled atomic reaction, actually. How about that for a little history for you?
Right.
Manhattan Project. At that point, you're pretty much sure you are done playing football in that stadium. They did bring back Division III football about, I think, 15, 20 years ago, but it's obviously just that. But if you have any risk of being sued like this for major trauma, why would you even bother with Division II or Division III? This is one more factor in the growing number of factors that are making me think that before long there'll be 64 teams left all playing big-time college football, and the rest will say it's just not worth it. Go ahead.
What are you hearing, John Ubakin, about from fans about this lawsuit in the NCAA? Are people aware of it?
They're aware of it, and this is where the phrase guilty pleasure kept on coming up in my conversations last year for this current book. The two groups I looked at are the two groups most often ignored and taken for granted by those who run college football, and that's the fans and the players, who are, of course, the very soul of the enterprise. And obviously the players are certainly concerned about this, but it struck me that even the most hardcore fans of college football are very concerned about this. I think the fans for college football are a bit different, maybe a lot different, from NFL fans who've got fantasy football leagues, they gamble on the game and so on. Very little of that happens at the college level. They're far more innately passionate, I think. And they're very worried about this.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the phrase guilty pleasure kept on coming up. If you're watching this and you love the violence, but you know that these guys might not be the same in 20, 30 years, it becomes a harder thing to watch.
Right, and we know that college football players are not getting paid millions to do it either.
They're getting paid a scholarship, which I will say, if you're out of state at Iowa, that can add up to $500,000 pretty quickly for a fifth-year senior who's also getting free food and the food is expensive and all the rest. You do get a fair amount out of it as an athlete, but you're not set for life, and you're not even set for the next year after you graduate.
John Ubakin, before we let you go, I know your expertise, your book, Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football, looks at collegiate football. But have you thought about further down the line the feeders into those programs, the implications for high school and junior high?
No question. And I know that the NFL and college are better be worried about that as well, because if the base of the pyramid shrinks, the pyramid is not going to be as high. That's basic math. And when President Obama himself says that if he had sons, he'd have to think twice before letting them play football, truly that has got a ripple effect. So right now they are probably working very urgently at the lower levels to fix this problem.
Okay, we'll find out about that. Explore in the rest of our program. John Ubakin, sports commentator for Michigan Public Radio, Fourth and Long, the title of his book. John, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're talking about the future of football, considering the science of head trauma and concussions. Have concerns about concussions changed your mind about letting your kids play tackle football in school? We want to hear perhaps about a conversation you had with a neighbor or some other parent at your school talking about football. 1-866-780-9100. Your thoughts. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us next of all, Dr. Andy Peterson, Assistant Clinical Professor of Pediatrics and Sports Medicine at the University of Iowa Children's Hospital. Dr. Peterson, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
I ask you to get a little closer to the microphone. If you could slide that over to you a little bit more. Remind us, what do we know now about concussion and head trauma connected with football?
We know that football causes concussions. We know that once you've had concussions, you're more likely to get future concussions, and certain people seem to be prone to them. I think it's difficult at this point to know what exactly some of the long-term effects of playing football at a high level are. We're starting to get a few hints. So we're learning from former NFL players that they have about a threefold increased risk of depression compared to the general population. We know that former NFL players have about a 10-time risk of dementia compared to the general population. And what we're learning from Ann McKee's data at Boston and some of the CDC brain biopsy studies is that at least some former professional football players have developed a problem called chronic traumatic encephalopathy or tau encephalopathy. And I think that's gotten a lot of attention in the press lately because that's a permanent brain disease. That's something that's damaged to your brain that can't be undone. There's no medications. There's no treatments. There's no real way to fix that problem once it develops. And if a sizable number of former NFL players are ending up with this problem, that's a real public health burden.
Mm-hmm. Tell me why it is that we've had decades and decades of football in this country, and it's been, what, where can we put the point, the last 10 or 15 years that the concern, the science has really delivered some worrying studies?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because there's some worrying studies, like we just talked about, these increased risks of depression, dementia, and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. But overall, football is as safe as it's ever been. You know, the number of deaths in football at all levels, you know, 4.2 million football players last year in the United States, there was only two deaths across all of football last year from direct causes related to the game. Tackling rules changes dating back to the mid-1970s have really dramatically decreased the risk of spinal cord injury, have decreased the risk of skull fracture and bleeding into the brain, and deaths have gone down precipitously. So football is about as safe as it's ever been. However, there's been a bit of a perfect storm of events that have given us new insight into how people recover or rather don't recover from concussions. And I think as people are learning more about the risks of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, as people have learned that second impact syndrome is a real event, we weren't sure that second impact syndrome where people who have a concussion get hit in the head and then subsequently die because of brain swelling. Up until a few years ago, we weren't entirely sure that that was even real, but a big paper by Barry Marin's group out of the Twin Cities demonstrated that it's a real phenomenon. And I think, it was, frankly, the internet and social media and people having frank conversations about the risk of football has dramatically increased our awareness of these mm-hmm. concerns.
Tell us what's happening with the brain, because we've increased helmet technology. It's become much better. Padding for the rest of the body has become much better. And we can help protect the brain to a certain extent. Why?
Yeah, so maybe a step back about helmets. Helmets don't prevent concussions at all. There's no evidence at all that the type of helmet, the way the helmet fits, how new the helmet is, how well-conditioned is, that they prevent concussions at all. They prevent skull fractures, and they prevent subdural hematomas and bleeding into the brain, things that are bad. But they don't prevent concussions at all. However, rule changes do prevent concussions. So avoiding hitting with the head, making head-to-head contact, hopefully the NFL rule change that will change the way ball carriers have to end the play by not leading with their head will make a difference. And the rule change a few years ago with kickoffs has made a difference in the number of concussions. But helmets don't make a difference.
And explain that, because the helmet, as I understand, the helmet can protect the skull, but not the brain inside the skull.
Correct. It diffuses the force. It does not absorb the force. So the force is still transmitted to the brain. And a concussion isn't so much caused by the direct impact on the brain as the shear forces throughout the brain. So the individual nerve cells are damaged. The axons themselves are damaged and become leaky. And some excitatory neurotransmitters leak out. There becomes some electrolyte imbalance across the cell membrane that the cells then need to work very hard to try to restore. And there becomes an energy imbalance. But that can't be protected from a direct blow. It's something that these transmitted blows, even through a helmet or even through a direct hard blow to the body, there's no real way to prevent it.
Dr. Andrew Peterson is with us, Assistant Clinical Professor of Pediatrics and Sports Medicine at the University of Iowa Children's Hospital. And if you'd like to join us, 1-866-780-9100, talking about the future of football. Dr. Peterson there were the reminder of what's been found out about head trauma and concussions connected with football. Let's have three other gentlemen join our conversation now. First of all, Nate Kading is with us, Hawkeye place kicker from 2000 to 2003 and former NFL place kicker for the San Diego Chargers for 9 years from 2004 through 2012. Nate Kading, welcome to our studio.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Also joining us in our Des Moines studio, Tom Wilson, head football coach and athletic director for Dowling Catholic High School in Des Moines. Tom Wilson, welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Jim Angstman is with us, executive director for the Metro Youth Football Association in Cedar Rapids in our Iowa City studio. Jim, welcome to you.
Thanks, Ben.
Let me start with you, Nate Kading. You, of course, have had many years of experience in the NFL and more interestingly, during a time when we're finding out your 8 years, 2004 through 2012, those years when there is a growing awareness of the dangers of head trauma among football players, what were you hearing? Did you notice the conversations at all changing among your teammates on the Chargers, for instance?
Absolutely. Over the 8 years that I was in the locker room, and I'll preface this by saying that my teammates got paid to hit people, and I got paid as a place kicker to run away from anybody that was coming trying to hit me. But I was in the middle of the locker room and had these discussions with my teammates. And when I went into the NFL in 2004, no one said peep about head trauma or concussions. But even especially within the last year or two, the dialogue picked up quite a bit amongst the teammates, and especially with rookies that came in. One of the things that found recurring were guys saying, man, I'm not going to play 13, 14, 15 years like a Ray Lewis. If I can just get in and be smart with my money, play 6, 7, 8 years, get out. I mean, there and just move on with my life where there aren't any of these lingering issues from head trauma. I mean, it's very prevalent on these players' minds. And we were out in San Diego and we had the issue with Junior Seau, who committed suicide and was dealing with what seemed to be a whole host of problems, and one of which perhaps was this byproduct of continued head trauma as a 16, 17-year NFL player. And that was very real with the players in our locker room and players at every position. And it's an issue that certainly is now here on the forefront that wasn't there a decade ago.
Did it play any part in you leaving the NFL?
No, I luckily avoided pretty much any and all head contact, but I left for other injuries in my leg, my kicking leg.
Okay. I'm wondering, so in that short space of time, football players recognizing it, the way you're describing it, it's almost as if they see it as roulette, that I'll play this for a few years and hope the ball doesn't drop on my number and come out with my money.
Right. I think the risk, at least for the smart ones, will probably be more calculated than it was a decade ago. You know, with credit to, you know, incredibly brilliant people like Dr. Peterson and the media that have made this more of an issue, and they are aware of it. I mean, I've growing up all through high school, college, NFL, you are never once sat down and said there is risk, a concussion risk by playing football. That's something that's never explicitly addressed. I mean, I don't know if they assume that you just understand that or what, but it's nothing that you're ever told, and people just play. They go out and they play the game.
Nate Kading, stay with us. We want to talk to Tom Wilson, head football coach and athletic director for Dowling Catholic High School. How is this filtering down? That's the main question of this hour, Tom Wilson. As head football coach there at Dowling, one of the real high school powerhouses over decades in the state at the high school level, what are you hearing? How is this coming down to you?
Well, I don't think there's any question there's a concern, really, with our youth and with our parents alike and the welfare of their child. And as you mentioned, obviously at Dowling, football is important to our athletic department and important to the history of the school. But yet the welfare of our kids is certainly more important. So I think through our athletic association, they've done a very good job of emphasizing the concussions, signs of concussions, ways to try to prevent concussions. I think it's through education and really concussion awareness that we can try to make our kids as safe as they possibly can be.
Mm-hmm. You're making people aware of the signs of concussions and setting people out longer, but what about the game itself to prevent concussions? Anything there?
Well, obviously, you mentioned this earlier with really technique and safety within practices and how that's going to change the game. I think that has been ongoing really for the last few years at least, if not longer than that, trying to keep the head out of football and really proper technique. And some of it, you know, as much as you hate to say it, is going to happen. And it is part of the game. But I think as coaches, we certainly have to have a responsibility to try to teach the techniques that are going to keep the kids as safe as we can.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at participation in Iowa high school football. The numbers here from 2008, 21,881, nearly 22,000. 4 years later, 2012, it's 20,755. So a couple thousand in decline, nearly. What do you see in this decline connected with the growing awareness about concussions and head trauma? Do you see a connection?
Well, I think there's certainly a connection. And you know, you'll probably bring on this up later, but, you know, within our youth sports, it's very difficult to understand the background of each child that comes into your program. You know, within our Catholic Football League, there could be a child that has a concussion within that Catholic Football League or our youth program, and we need to make sure that we have documentation of that, because then if they come into our high school, obviously that could have an impact on their future. And we've certainly done some things to try to overcome that, or at least give us a better idea of the background of each child. But I certainly believe a decline has something to do with the injury factor.
Jim Angstman, Executive Director for Metro Youth Football Association in Cedar Rapids. Now, I know you and Dr. Peterson are working together to collect injury data for the first time. And we have to be reminded that you work with younger kids, right?
Correct. Our tackle program is 4th, 5th, and 6th grade.
Okay. So what is the program? And Dr. Peterson, please join in there. We've got to go to a break in a minute, but give us what's going on in this program, study.
All of our games are monitored by St. Luke's Unity Point trainers. And we've asked them, and they do, they collect data, injury data on players that are unable to go back into a game.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Dr. Peterson, what do you hope to gain from this data once you have it over this year, following years?
A better understanding of the actual risks at the younger levels. So everything that's out there about youth football is really based on estimates in the number of participants and the number of exposures. And in order to accurately get an idea of what the injury risk is in youth football, you need an accurate denominator. And in order to be able to get that, we need to have a way to monitor the practices and collect the number of exposures that people have in addition to the injuries that they're getting. So that's what this study adds. No one's really done that before.
Mm-hmm. Jim, we know at this level, 3rd and 4th grade, that we can just watch it and see that it's not as dangerous, right?
Yes, hopefully. We're very proactive from the safety perspective. We've aligned ourselves with USA Football. We're a pilot program for USA Football. We're very involved in teaching the heads-up training technique for tackling, and all of our head coaches and elite assistant coaches are certified through USA Football.
Okay, we're going to continue our discussion about the future of football with our guests, Jim Angstman, Executive Director for Metro Youth Football Association in Cedar Rapids. Tom Wilson is with the Dowling Catholic High School in Des Moines, head football coach, also athletic director there. Nate Kading is with us, former NFL player, former Hawkeye. Dr. Andy Peterson is with us, and let's bring in the band, because what is football without the band? And we're going to come back and ask you to join our conversation. Have concerns about head trauma? Concussion changed your mind about letting your kids play tackle football in school? What questions do you have for our expert on concussions, Dr. Andy Peterson, connected to football? 1-866-780-9100. Also, we want to talk about the future of football. That very first question thrown out by our first guest, can we make football safer and retain what we love about the game? Your thoughts on that, your questions about that, 1-866-780-9100. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about the future of football, a couple of things that have happened within the past few months, past few weeks. The NFL settlement with about 4,500 retired football players, for medical benefits, other things to compensate for those who have suffered concussions and related injuries during their careers. Just last week, three former college football players suing the NCAA, claiming that the institution failed to educate players and disclose the risks of concussion. So this hour, we're exploring whether concerns about head trauma at the highest levels of the game are filtering down to high school and youth levels in Iowa and what football's future may be. Players at the Metro Youth Football Association had their first games at the complex in Cedar Rapids this past Sunday. Iowa Public Radio's Catherine Perkins was there and talked to some parents at the sixth grade games and asked if they had any concerns for safety with their children playing football. And here's what they had to say.
None at all. Never even crossed my mind. I was, as soon as he was able to play, it was, do you want to do it? Yep, okay. And it's always asking the kids first, you know, that's my big thing, making sure my kids want to do it. And he did, so I never even thought twice about it.
Not really. I mean, it's injuries are going to come with the sport, but it's nothing serious, hopefully. I mean, if he was playing water polo or something, and might not have the contact, but I'm all right with that.
Yes, they do. Very much so. And especially because of all the talk about, like, concussions and that and everything. So most definitely.
There is the illusion that soccer or that, I'm sorry, that football is such a violent game, and why would you have your kid go out and play that game? But again, if coaches teach the kids how to do it right, the proper way to do things, then it's as safe as soccer and baseball and any other sport there is.
Sampling of parents at Sunday night's sixth grade games at the Metro Youth Football Association complex in Cedar Rapids. Our guest this hour as we contemplate the future of football with you. Nate Kading is with us, former NFL place kicker for the San Diego Chargers, former Hawkeye, of course. Dr. Andy Peterson with us of the University of Iowa Children's Hospital. Tom Wilson, head football coach for Dowling Catholic High School in Des Moines. He's also the athletic director for Dowling. Jim Angstman is with us, executive director for Metro Youth Football Association in Cedar Rapids. Well, we were taken there on site to hear some of the parents to talk about this sixth grade game, parents of those. Dr. Andy Peterson, you're tracking injury data, head trauma among these people, along with coordinating with Jim Angstman there. But before the break, we talked about the decline in numbers in high school football between 2008 and 2012. But you have some interesting information about how the decline is not happening among the younger players.
Yeah, the American Football Coaches Committee releases a report every year. It's mainly about injuries, but it's also about participation rates and things like that. And while the number of high school and post-high school players has decreased, there's fewer players now in high school and post-high school, the number of youth football players has exploded. So it's gone from about 1.8 million high school and post-high school players 10 years ago to about 1.1 million now. But the number of youth football players has gone from about 1.5 million to 3 million, so a doubling in the number of youth football players. So while the perception is that there's less football in the United States right now, it's actually gone up over the past decade.
Mm-hmm. Jim Angstman, do we know why that is?
No, I don't think so. It's a popular sport. I mean, the program that we offer is, I'm not going to say it's non-competitive, and we don't keep track of wins and losses. But I think everybody's watching it on TV, and that makes it popular for the kids to want to play the mm-hmm. sport.
It makes sense that the sport is popular, at Dr. Peterson, and when we observe youth playing, we don't have the worrying crunches that we see when we get the impacts of larger bodies hitting each other.
Yeah, exactly. The injury risk in football increases almost linearly as you get older, and as the game becomes bigger and faster and stronger and the collisions become bigger and harder, the injury risk goes up. It's fairly intuitive, and the research bears that out. So the bigger you are and the faster you run, the bigger collisions you have and the more likely you are to get hurt. So at the youth football level, we don't think there's that many injuries. Again, it's still being studied. But obviously, as you get into the high school, college, and football and professional levels, there is a very high injury rate in football.
Nate Kading, you have launched a youth football league in the Iowa City area called the Red Zone Youth Football League. So is this an alternative that you're offering, or is it a stage before you get to tackle?
Yeah, it's absolutely an alternative. It's part of the NFL. The NFL runs an NFL flag league across the country, and that has shown the most growth of participation over the last few years. And speaking to Dr. Peterson's point, I mean, with the fact that the youth football has gone up, but high school has gone down, that speaks to the primary problem. Something's wrong with the way that we're introducing the sport today to the young players. The primary objective should be to promote future participation, because the sport offer so many great teaching lessons as a extracurricular activity in the secondary education system. Being able to work together with team and having diverse people from diverse backgrounds and teaching them the importance of hard work and togetherness and respect and responsibility. We're losing kids. They're starting off in youth football and something's happening. They're getting turned off from the game.
So what is wrong about the approach that you're trying to...
I have two boys. They're not going to play tackle football until they get into seventh grade. I don't think there's any need for it. When I was here at the University of Iowa in the College of Education, the first thing they taught us when I was getting my teaching certification was, as you're making a lesson plan, you have to identify your objectives. And for me, the objectives of any youth sport, whether it be football or soccer or baseball, are to have these kids go out, have them be active, have them learn the skills that are necessary in catching, running, being good, moving in space. Have fun and promote future participation. And you can do that in tackle football and flag football. And if you look at the two together, to me, inherently, flag football has less of a risk of injury and especially less of a risk of this cumulative concussions going forward.
Mm-hmm. And you said in your reaching out to tackle football coaches around the state, there's been a positive response.
When we launched the league, we went around and pulled and sat down with a majority of the high school coaches here in the area, and all of them, pretty much to a T, encouraged their kids to start the enter into tackle football in the seventh grade. And I think there needs to be a better progression. I think it's fine if we start doing some of these heads up football models when they get into sixth grade, so that they're better prepared when they enter into the junior high level to be better tacklers. I think that's important. Whether it's in more of a controlled environment, they're getting the pads on, the helmet on, and they're doing it. But there needs to be a developmental strategy. It shouldn't just be to slap the pads on and go out and play football at a when they're 8, 9 years old.
Nate Kading is with us. Join our conversation 1-866-780-9100 as we talk about the future of football. Let's go to our phones. Let's go to Humboldt, where Joe is waiting on the line. Hi, Joe. Welcome.
Hello. How's it going today? This is a great topic.
Thank you. What do you have to chip in, Joe?
Well, actually, I'm in the business. I might know Tom, Hader Manufacturing in Humboldt. I'm the R&D director here, and we make a lot of football equipment, and we've been doing it for a long time, started by my dad, who was a football coach. So it's, obviously a topic near and dear to my heart. I guess, I like what I'm hearing from Nick Kading there. The big thing is the great lessons that you can get out of football, and we don't want to lose that. I want to mention some of the work that we've been doing, and I think this is, and I might check with the people there, if they've heard of Coach Bobby Hosea and his Train 'Em Up Academies, and this isn't a plug for them, I'm not working for them, but he was really the first coach that I really saw who was talking about heads-up football and using the right techniques and proper techniques, and we all know there are times in football, and the higher level up you get, the more you're going to have those diving tackles, and you're just going to have to stick your head into some situations. But really trying to train the proper techniques and teaching the young kids that, their body goes where their head goes, and they got to keep their head up, and that really does a lot for proper technique in football. And, the other comment I guess I have is, we're learning so much so quickly with guys like Dr. Peterson, really getting involved in this. And I don't want people to lose sight of the fact that we're really becoming aware of the risk of concussions. I mean, I only played high school football. I didn't play college football. But I'm sure Tom Wilson can back me up on this. In the 1970s, when you played high school football, if you got a dinger, we called them, they gave you smelling salts, and you jump right back in the game. And, thank goodness we're not doing that kind of stuff.
Right, and it was really something for everybody to chuckle about, right? You're staggering around on the field.
Yeah, I don't remember the last half of the game against Algona. Ah, you're crazy. You made five tackles, or that wasn't me. That was a Reimers in Humboldt. But that's the kind of things that happen.
Joe, thank you for joining us from Humboldt. Nate Kading wanted to jump in here after that comment.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I think some of this machismo culture that has been so ingrained into football is now getting washed out by the science and the medicine as we learn more about it, which I think is great and is only going to help the future viability of the sport.
Jim Angstman, he mentioned heads-up program. You're a pilot for the USA Football's heads-up program. What is heads-up, and what else can be done to make it safer, especially for youth?
Well, the Heads Up program's through USA Football, which is a partnership between, I understand, the NFL and the NFL Players Association. And you may see the advertisements before, during, and after games. They are trying to teach a more safe approach to tackling.
Okay. Tom Wilson, I know you're involved with youth football there, too. What else can be done in the practice when you're coaching these younger kids?
Well, to be honest with you, I couldn't agree more with Nate Kading. I think he's dead on. I don't understand what the hurry is in youth sports to put pads on and to start knocking kids around. I don't think it makes them better high school football players. And it becomes a very much a competitive environment. You know, we've seen AAU basketball tournaments and things like that pop up. Well, football is now doing the same thing. You know, we had a team put together within our youth league that was affiliated with our youth league, and they played like 17, 18 football games because they were going to tournaments, sometimes two, three, four games in a weekend. And to me, that's unbelievable. And I guess I don't understand what the philosophy is. And Nate mentioned the goals. So what's the ultimate goal of youth football? And I think that certainly needs to be looked at. I think it has everything to do with the injury factor and these kids getting started so early.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about what Nate mentioned there about the culture of football, people getting dinged and the machismo? Do you, Tom Wilson, see that changing? So it's certainly not something we want to chuckle about when somebody – as we say, gets their bell rung.
Well, I think it's changing just as we get better educated. You know, the caller was right. You know, back when, you know, a lot of us played, you know, that was part of the culture. Well, now, you know, you've got people that are certainly looking for the different signs. It's like I said earlier, well, what's the signs of a possible concussion? And I think through education and awareness, we can certainly get better. That doesn't make it foolproof, but I think we can certainly get better that we're not sending kids back out there when they certainly shouldn't be.
Ray in Mason City joining us. Hi, Ray. What's on your mind as we talk about the future of football? Ray, are you there on the phone?
Yes.
Yes. Go ahead, sir. You're on the phone. What do you have to chip in?
I'm glad to hear what the coach and the youth man said. When I first started hearing, when I was in high school back in the 50s, in fact, in junior high, we didn't even have a face mask. But we were taught what they're teaching now. Heads up, put your head to the side, and use your shoulder. In the 60s, it was the first time I heard coaches tell them to use the head, use that helmet as a weapon. And I thought it was stupid then, and I still do, because you're asking for trouble. Mm. And it has been, you know, since proved out that way.
Ray in Mason City, thank you for perspective from the 1950s. Nate Kading.
That's a good point, and the NFL has made a conscious effort both in how they enforce rules on the field. I mean, you've seen massive fines upwards to $100,000 for people that have made hits head-to-head, helmet-to-helmet. It's emphasized in locker rooms, in meeting rooms from coaches. And he said, yeah, back in the day, they said, yeah, hey, get your head, do whatever it takes to get the guy down, hurt him, you know, and, right, and force your head on, hit his head onto your head. And you don't see that anymore. Now you have coaches actively in NFL locker rooms telling people, don't use your head. Get your head off to the side. Do things the right way. I want to look out for your health and your betterment.
And that's gone. That went in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, went in hand with the development of helmets. As we got better helmets, we thought, oh, we can use them as – we can use them as weapons, right, Dr. Peterson?
Yeah, this is actually a fascinating part of the history of football. So there were many, many fatalities in football in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. In fact, there was a movement to outlaw the game in the 40s and 50s. And part of the move towards polycarbonate helmets was in response to that. And they did their job. They dramatically decreased the number of skull fractures and brain bleeds and decreased the number of deaths on the field. However, it also gave players a new weapon. And from the mid-1950s until really the early 1970s, it was part of the game to use the helmet as a weapon. The spearing rule came along in 1976 and really changed how people used their head in the game, and there was a dramatic decrease in the number of cervical spine injuries and deaths on the field in response to that. The change that's happened more recently is very small compared to that change, right? I mean, the number of injuries that we're talking about from trying to put your head on the ball versus putting your head outside the opposing player is minor compared to this change in moving to hard helmets and then moving away from spearing.
Let's hear another voice collected by Iowa Public Radio's Catherine Perkins. Dean Zarodnik has been coaching his sons in flag and tackle football for 6 years. He says Metro Youth Football Association is part of the heads-up effort sponsored by USA Football, and he does his best to teach them proper technique.
Most injuries occur when the player does not have their head up, whether they're blocking, whether they're tackling. Keeping that head up is very important, and not only for the safety, but also for you know, being on the field, you've got to know where the guy you're blocking is, the guy you're tackling is. So you've got to have your head up anyway. So it's just, I mean, it's good football technique anyways. But teaching the kids proper techniques as far as, you know, getting your hips down when you're blocking and when you're tackling, rather than bending at the waist, you got to lower your hips and teach them how to take on the contact and be prepared for it, rather than, you know, it's when injuries occur when one player is not going hard or standing still and the other player is coming in full blast. That's when an injury occurs. So trying to teach the kids that, you know, it's against human instinct, but the harder you go, the less chance there is of an injury. And that's hard for anyone to understand, but especially kids, but that's something that you try and get them to understand.
That's Dean Zarodnik, a sixth grade tackle football coach for Metro Youth Football Association. So, Nate Kading, this, when we contemplate the future here of football in the next few minutes, let's all kind of put our heads together and sort of forecast where we're going to be in 5 or 10 years. Where do you hope we'll be? We're talking about the type of play, the coaching of the play making a difference in heads-up football example, the equipment, the rules. Describe what you see as a safe form of tackle football in the next few years developing.
The game will get safer, but I think the main takeaway is that it will always be the riskiest sport out there available from a high school athlete on their menu items of what they can select. And I think that's something that's going to continue to trouble the game as it goes forward. As I want my boys if they want to play tackle football, they can play tackle football. I'll let them make that decision. I'll encourage them to play because I think that the benefits definitely outweigh the risks. But I think you're going to have more and more young athletes and parents that are going to have to make that decision. Do the risks of injury outweigh the rewards of the game? I think it's. But I think there's a lot of great steps. I think by being here today and having this discussion is one of the first steps in terms of educating parents and young football players out there throughout the state.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do we have coaches knowing how to coach tackle football at these youth ages? Do we have everybody on board being informed of the proper way to coach, the safer way to coach kids how to play tackle?
I'm going to say yes, and I'm going to base that on the fact that at least in our league, our coaches are required to take this online certification and to go to the heads up training, and we do monitor it very closely.
What's your feeling on that, Tom Wilson in Des Moines?
I think they're certainly on the right track. I think USA Football does a great job. We've been working with them in our Catholic Football League. And when he says yes, I would certainly agree with that because I've looked over the material, and I think it's very, very good, and I think they're certainly on the right track.
Okay. Aaron is joining us from Dubuque. He called 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Pretty good. What's your slant on football?
Well, I coached high school football at the varsity level in the state for several years, and I kind of got out of it. I think one of the things that we don't talk about is high school football is very much 10 to 15 years behind where the NFL is at developing and the way we develop players. You know, we still are in this bigger, faster, stronger mentality where we're hanging weight on these kids that, frankly, they're just not prepared to handle, whereas the NFL has started to go more to a fitness level. I play rugby, and honestly, I would encourage my kids to play rugby over football from – And I know it doesn't sound like it makes sense, but from a safety standpoint, with the emphasis on fitness and proper technique and all the rules being about player safety, I look at it and see rugby as a much safer game, an opportunity to learn a lot of the same skills. But I saw in 3 years four major lower leg breaks on kids, and I can directly attribute at least three of those to a kid carrying more weight than his body's prepared to handle.
Mm-hmm. Aaron in Dubuque, thank you very much for those observations, because it really is in these youth sports, especially in junior high, Dr. Peterson, that you can have some incredible weight differences. And I know in a lot of youth football, seventh graders, they separate by weight, but then at some point they're all joined up and you can have a differential of, what, 50, 60 pounds or more when you have a collision, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because those differentials occur at all levels of the game, right? I mean, Nate's seen people in the NFL that are a couple times his size as well, right? There's large differentials at every level of the game. Interestingly, there is some data that, to get to your caller's point, that being overweight or obese increases your risk of lower extremity fractures. So we've learned that actually from football, that your risk of fracture goes up the bigger you get. So there might be something to that. I also think that the trend has been towards more fitness type of training and rather just trying to increase mass and size on players over the last while. Don't get me wrong, players are still very, very big, but I think the trend has been the other direction.
Dr. Andrew Peterson, as we look at this and look into the future, can can we do all these things, change the rules, enforce them better to make the game safer so that it will still exist and be enjoyed by players with few injuries and fans as well?
Yeah, safer, I think, is a reasonable goal. I think safe is an unreasonable goal. It's a violent, inherently violent game. It's going to stay violent. And there's going to be risks, and people need to be aware of those risks coming in. Hopefully decisions about what football looks like, rule changes, and the types of people that are allowed to participate in football are made by rational people rather than emotional ones.
Okay, Jim Angstman, I think you'll have the last word here. We're running out of time. Okay.
Safety-wise, the top 20% in weights do not get to carry the ball. They have a red stripe down the middle of their helmets, and they're going to play on the line both defensively and offensively, so we don't have the collisions between 150-pound and maybe a 60-pounder.
Is that something that's adopted now statewide or just
in that's our league. That's in our league.
Okay, very good. Well, here comes the band. It must be time for us to go. I want to thank you all for joining us this half hour. Jim Angstman, Executive Director for Metro Youth Football Association in Cedar Rapids. Tom Wilson, head football coach for Dowling Catholic High School in West Des Moines. I think I said Des Moines earlier. Sorry about that, Tom. Thank you for coming into our Des Moines studio, though.
Thank you.
Dr. Andy Peterson with us of the University of Iowa Children's Hospital. Thank you for your expertise.
Thank you for having me.
And Nate Kading, former NFL player, place kicker for the San Diego Chargers and Hawkeye. Nate Kading, thank you for coming in today. We hope to hear from you again about some other sports topics.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Our executive director is Catherine Perkins. Thanks for joining us.